Okay, welcome back, everyone, and everyone at home following us online. We hear there is a large crowd following the talks. So the last talk during this afternoon session is by Nergus Mahavatvala, who's going to be telling us about the warp side of the universe and the importance of detecting gravitational waves. Nergus?
So, hi, everyone. So this is my title slide, and I'm going to talk about exploring the warp side of the universe. There's a few things I do want to say up front. So first thing is, you see that's my name up there, Nergus. But that's just done because I'm vain. Really, the work I'm going to talk about is the work of many hundreds of people, both in the LIGO laboratory and the LIGO scientific collaboration. And all of the US part of the work I'm going to tell you about is funded by the US National Science Foundation. So the warp side of the universe, no surprise to most of you, is a story about the quest for gravitational waves. And so here's what Einstein's legacies are for us, standing here over 100 years after he did his most important works. So gravitational wave astrophysics is about to take off. And that's the case I'm going to make. That's my message to you today for the next few minutes. And I wrote there within this decade, but I'll even go out on a limb and say maybe even within the next 5 years there's going to be big and interesting things to think about. So there's this new generation of terrestrial gravitational wave detectors, and they're coming online now. And so they're the most sensitive detectors we've ever operated, and their sensitivity is actually better than an attometer, so 10 to the minus 19 meters of displacement, and soon you'll be able to put a scale on that number. Now, it turns out that when you reach that level of precision, the quantum uncertainty imposes a fundamental limit on how well these detectors can work. And there's an irony in here that I love to think about, which is that Einstein actually struggled with both these ideas, the idea of gravitational radiation, but also the idea of quantum uncertainty. All right, so gravitational waves are a quick primer. They're predicted by Einstein's general relativity in 1916. They manifest themselves as ripples of the space-time fabric. Now, for our purposes, when we're trying to detect these here on the Earth, the way to think about them is that they stretch and squeeze the space-time transverse to their direction of propagation. And what this really means is that if a gravitational wave passes through a space-time object like me, it will stretch and shrink me at the frequency of the oscillation of the wave. And that's really how you can think about what it does. Now, if we try to put a scale on it, a gravitational wave, as it passes through a space-time region of length L, and a wave of amplitude H will change that space-time region by an amount delta L. So it's like a tidal force. It's a relative displacement. So what emits gravitational waves? Well, it's very, as we all know, gravity is a very weak force. And so it's very hard to imagine laboratory sources. They're entirely astrophysical sources. So the two ingredients we need for making a good gravitational wave source is we need lots of mass and we need acceleration. And very similar to electromagnetic radiation, where you need accelerating charge, here we need accelerating mass. And the way that we got to think about this is what regions of space can we pack a lot of mass into? These are usually compact objects, like neutron stars or black holes. And then to get decent amounts of accelerations, we need the motions of those objects to be either in orbits or undergoing explosions or collisions. So this is a very violent and warped part of astrophysics that we study with gravitational radiation now. It turns out that deformation of rotating stars can also radiate gravitational waves, and we're confident that there is a relic background radiation of gravitational waves from the Big Bang. Very much like we have the cosmic microwave background, we have a relic background of gravitational waves. So if you take a pair of neutron stars and you put them in a binary orbit around each other, and you put them in a galaxy not too far from our own, say in the Virgo cluster, about 15 megaparsecs or 50 million light years away, you can make a rough estimate for what would be the amplitude of a gravitational wave from such a source in the last few minutes before the two neutron stars merge. And you'd find that to be 10 to the minus 21. That's the scale. Now, it's dimensionless, as you can guess, because it's a change in length per length. So a dimensionless number, no matter how big or small, doesn't really scare us. But obviously, as soon as you put a dimension on this with distance, you'll see that it's a very tiny number. So I'm being an object of a space-time object of size about a meter, my dimensions would change by 10 to the minus 21 meter if this gravitational wave passed through me. So not easy to detect. So a bit of history about gravitational waves. So it turns out, of course, that they were first proposed by Einstein in his seminal 1916 paper on general relativity. But he actually got the first correct formulation 2 years later. So the initial formulation was not quite right. He himself actually remained very, very uncertain about them, not just how weak they were, but which he was very unhappy about, but also of their very existence. And he did go back and forth. And in fact, in 1937, he submitted a retraction in a paper with Rosen, and then quickly retracted the retraction in the same year after other discussions. But really, the controversy and doubts didn't subside until the mid-1950s with the work of Feynman and others. As has been said many times today, the final say comes from experiment and observation, as always. And that didn't come to us until the 1970s with the discovery of a binary pulsar system, PSR 1913 plus 16. Now, what was this? This was a pair of neutron stars that were orbiting each other and quite close in their orbit. So they were quite a relativistic system, And one of the neutron stars was a pulsar. Now, why was this a wonderful thing? Because it was a pulsar with its lighthouse beam pointed towards us. So Hulse and Taylor were able to measure the orbital period of this binary system as a function of time. And what they found was that the orbital period was decaying, or another way to say that was that these two neutron stars were getting closer to each other in their orbit. Now, why? Because as they orbit each other, they're radiating gravitational waves. The energy carried away by the gravitational radiation comes from the orbit. So measuring the orbit shrinking is a measure of the gravitational wave energy carried away. And in fact, they were able to fit that exactly to the prediction from GR. And I say fit, but it's actually a zero-parameter fit. They measured the parameters of their binary system and then were able to predict exactly what the radiation, what the decay in the orbit should be due to gravitational radiation. So this is widely accepted as a detection of gravitational waves, and also greatly impressed Sweden, and they went, they got the Nobel Prize in 1993. Okay, so what are some of the big questions? So we know they're out there, and this has been said again before today. What are some of the big questions that we can pose for gravitational wave astrophysics? So, neutron stars, what are the things we don't know about them that we would love to know? What is the equation of state? What is their structure? What is the maximum mass a neutron star can have? What are their populations? How many are in binaries? What is the population of black holes? That's another question we don't know. Do they exist in binaries? How often do they form binaries? How do they form at all? How do they die? How does nature grow a supermassive black hole? Are black holes characterized only by their mass and spin, as GR would have us believe? Can we map out spacetimes around black holes? So these are some of the questions that we hope to answer with observations of gravitational waves. And in most cases, these are not easily answered using electromagnetic radiation and conventional astrophysical telescopes. Now, core collapse supernovae, these are some of the harder questions that we're asking. What are the explosion mechanisms? So it turns out that we don't really know what causes core collapse supernovae to explode and how. What is the structure and dynamics of the progenitor star? What's going on deep inside the core? Now, why is that question answerable by gravitational radiation and not by observing with telescopes? Well, in part because it turns out gravitational waves are very aloof. They do not interact with with matter like photons do. So we can use them to probe the inner cores of these processes, which are opaque to photons, because we see photons only at the surface of these systems. Now, similarly with primordial gravitational wave background, so this is the gravitational wave background from very right after inflation. These are things we can probe in the early universe. And I'd like to really take a second to point out that when we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're looking at the universe when it was 400,000 years old. And that's for the same reason. These photons, they're too friendly. Whenever they met matter, they just interact. And so we had to wait for the universe to expand and cool enough before the photons decoupled. In the case of gravitational waves, that's not the case. They actually are streaming to us from the very earliest moments after the Big Bang. And so we can really ask questions about the early universe that we haven't been able to do with light. Now, there are also questions that we don't know how to ask yet, and I judiciously left that blank because that would be wild speculation, which I'm happy to do, but we'll do it separately over beer. All right. So let's take a big view of the gravitational wave spectrum. Now, you've seen in a workshop like Convergence many times this concept of the entire scale of the universe, whether you measure it in length scales or time scales or frequency scales. And so here, indeed, is a gravitational wave spectrum. It spans something like 20 orders of magnitude in frequency, and or if you prefer to think about it in wave period, starting at the very lowest frequencies or longest periods, which are essentially the age of the universe, or in length scale, the length of the universe, is where we expect to see this relic background of gravitational radiation. Now, if you then think about and that's the measurement that's being attempted with the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. Now, if you get down to sort of the nanohertz region or years in wave period, you get to being able to measure gravitational radiation using pulsar timing. So the process here is, if you have some large gravitational waves that are passing through a region between a pulsar and you, the observer, you can use the pulsars are very good clocks, and you can time them very well. And that timing will be disrupted if the space-time distance is changed by gravitational waves between the pulsar source and us. And that's a technique that's being used in these nanohertz region. Now, if you get to sort of the millihertz to subhertz region, this is a region where you expect to see gravitational waves from supermassive black holes like the ones at the centers of most galaxies, or also when supermassive black holes capture small little solar mass or equivalent black holes. And those are probed using space detectors. And then finally, nearest and dearest to my heart, and the thing that I'll spend most of my talk on, because that's what I work on, are terrestrial interferometers. And these these operate sort of in the 10 hertz to 10 kilohertz band, so it's a typical human audio band. And they are targeting sort of solar mass systems, like black holes that are a few to few tens of solar masses, or neutron star binaries, supernovae that are within our galaxy, etc. All right, so terrestrial interferometric detectors. What's the principle of detection? It's very simple. So if you wanted to make a gravitational wave detector, you actually could do it quite simply. The implementation itself is challenging. Imagine you had a laser, and you had a mirror, and you could reflect the laser light off the mirror, and it comes back at you. And if you had a really good clock, you just measure the light travel time. If there's a gravitational wave that passes through this region of space-time, that light travel time would change. You've made your measurement, and voila, there you are. Now, it turns out that because of the weakness of the small amplitude of the gravitational wave, even for very large distances like the kilometer scales on which we're doing these experiments here on the Earth, you don't have a clock that's good enough by orders of magnitude. So what we really do, in fact, is we build an interferometer where we take that same laser and we split the laser beam into two halves, reflect each half beam off of a mirror, and then those two beams recombine and interfere here at the beam splitter, and we measure the interference pattern. Now, why is that better? It's better because we no longer are making an absolute timing measurement. What we're doing is we're comparing the light travel time in this arm to that arm. So it's a relative measurement, and that makes it doable. So if you want to build a good gravitational wave detector, there's only two things you need to do. The one is you need to make mirrors that are very, very still. And that means you have to make them move less than this passing gravitational wave. And that means you have to be really good at vibration isolation, and you have to do a lot of control of the thermally driven fluctuations of these objects. Now, if you did all of those things, it would be kind of a lot of wasted effort if you didn't know how to probe very tiny motions. So, you know, you've made this mirror that's really, really still, but then you have no way of measuring how small those tiny motions. Well, that's where light enters, and we use laser light to probe the position of the mirror. So you can think of the laser light as our meter stick, and so we have to do ultra-high-precision optical measurement. And towards the very end of my talk, I'll also come back to the quantum fluctuations of the light and how those get in the way of these measurements. All right, so that's the two things we have to do. Now, there is a global network of detectors that are either under construction or are already operating across the planet. The two in the U.S. are the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO, one in Washington State, east of Seattle, and one in Louisiana, sort of between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And these are 4-kilometer-long detectors. The next longest detector that's built and operating is the Virgo detector in Italy, and that's a 3-kilometer-long detector. There is a 600-meter-long detector in Germany, the GEO-600 detector. And then under construction at the moment in a mine, and actually under the same mountain as Kamiokande, in the Kamioka mine in Japan, is Kagra, which is a 3-kilometer detector. Planned also in the next few years is a LIGO detector that is to be installed at a site in India. And then finally, question marks on these two, because this is a planned Australian detector. And then, of course, there is the space detector, LISA, and question marks for those, because those are at the moment unfunded. Okay, so if you had to take a tour of one of these detectors, here is an overhead view of our Louisiana Observatory, given away by the Pine Forest. And you can see that it's an aerial view, because what we're trying to go for is length is better. So the longer we can make these for a given amplitude gravitational wave, we have a larger change in length to measure. So we are in the business of trying to measure at the level of 10 to the minus 18 or 10 to the minus 19 meters of displacement of these mirrors that are 4 kilometers apart. If you look inside one of the arms, you'll see a stainless steel tube like this, which houses an ultra-high vacuum in which the laser beams travel. And then there is a little concrete housing, which has many uses, but also this one. So this is not a Photoshop picture. This is now at our Washington Observatory, where a local patrol came flying over this dune and simply didn't realize that there was this 4-kilometer-long barrier in the middle of the desert. So no one was hurt. If you go inside of the main observatory building, you see objects like these. These are our vacuum chambers. Each one of these houses one mirror of the interferometer. And to put a scale on it, if I were standing next to this vacuum chamber, the top of my head would be just below this row of viewports. Why do you need such a big chamber for a mirror? Well, a couple of reasons. The mirrors are big. When you propagate laser light for 4 kilometers, the beams grow big, same as this laser pointer, which is very small here, but expands as I go farther out. And so also, the mirrors are big, and then they have to be isolated from all of the vibrations of the environment. So they sit on these kinds of spring mass type vibration isolation systems. This is just one of many styles that proliferate in these detectors. And you can see this is just a spring mass system, sort of reminiscent of the shock absorbers in your cars. Now, the mirrors themselves are many tens of kilograms. Typically, they're 40 kilograms for advanced LIGO. And they're suspended as pendulums. And that's, again, another method for isolating them from environmental vibrations. This is a zoom-in of the mirror itself. This is what one of our lasers would look like. And then this is the control room from which the whole thing is controlled. And so if you've never had a chance to go to one of these, this was a little tour of the observatory. Now, if you do all of that, you can make a detector that has this performance. So LIGO is built in phases by design. The first phase of LIGO was completed in 2010. It's lasted sort of between 2000 and 2010. And the red curve here shows the target sensitivity that we had set for ourselves with this first phase of LIGO, which is called initial LIGO. And the blue curve and the green curve are the actual sensitivities realized, the blue curve in 2007 and the green curve in 2010. And in this case, they were limited by environmental noise at very low frequencies, so just seismicity, vibrations of the ground. At intermediate frequencies, they're limited by the thermally driven fluctuations of the mirror. And then at high frequencies, right here, above about a couple of hundred hertz, they're actually limited by the quantum fluctuations of the light. The fact that that photons come in discrete quanta was the limiting factor. Now, there's something I love to remind everyone and myself of when I look at this curve, and that is that this red curve over here, which we realized in 2007 to 2010, was initially calculated and written down by Ray Weiss in 1972. So it was 35 years later that we actually made it all work. And the thing that's really amazing about it is that factors of two came and went, but we almost always got back to this level. So this is what we could do in 2010. All right? Now, what can you do with a detector like this? There was a very interesting discussion earlier this morning about null experiments or experiments that don't measure signal. So let me give you a really nice example of what useful things such an experiment can do. So this first phase of LIGO operated, as I said, sort of in between 2007 and 2010 for many months to year of data, of useful data. And so it turns out that so here is GRB-070201, and the way gamma ray bursts are named, this is in the year 2007, in the second month, on the first day. So on February 1st, 2007, there was a very, very luminous gamma ray burst. And it was picked up by all of these gamma ray and X-ray instruments like SWIFT and Integral. And what they were able to do is they were able to localize that this source was consistent with being in the Andromeda galaxy, in M31, which is literally in our neighborhood. Now, one of the theories for what these short-lived gamma ray bursts could be, a leading model for these short-lived gamma ray bursts, is that they are actually the merger, the final phase of a pair of neutron stars or black holes as they crash into each other. So if that was the case, there should have been copious gravitational radiation from these sources. The LIGO detectors were on the air at the time, so we looked for a signal in LIGO, and of course we saw none. And what that led to was we could say with a greater than 99% confidence that GRB-070201 was not caused by a compact binary star merger in M31. And then that led to people reevaluating with other observations, and it was thought to be most likely a soft gamma repeater giant flare. So here is an example of what you can do if you have a sensitive enough instrument that doesn't measure a positive signal. But we clearly can't stop there. It's clear we still have no direct detections as yet. And as a result, we ask ourselves the question, can we search for even fainter sources or farther sources? In other words, can we make a more sensitive instrument? And the answer is, so here is where we are, we're in 2010. And so we designed a new instrument, which we call Advanced LIGO. And that has a target sensitivity given by this black curve, which relative to these curves is about a factor of 10 better at all frequencies. Now, I'm going to come back to this later, so I'm not going to tell you what are the main ingredients that went into making these improvements, but what I will tell you is that this curve here is limited entirely by the quantum vacuum fluctuations. So this is limited entirely by the fact that the electromagnetic vacuum is quantized and those have zero-point fluctuations. And we'll come back to that in a short bit. Okay, so Advanced LIGO is happening now. It was built in the same facilities and infrastructure of initial LIGO, but everything inside of the vacuum system was pulled out and new improved versions were installed. And you can see the activity that was going on surrounding that. And here's what we have today. So these are curves from our two observatories in LIGO. So the red curve is for our Washington Observatory and the blue curve for our Louisiana Observatory. And the green curve is what we predict at the quantum noise limit. Now, this is not at the final design sensitivity. It's 3 times better than it was for initial LIGO, and this is the performance with which we're going to start our first observing run, which will start this September. So in September 2015, Advanced LIGO will do its first observing run with a sensitivity to binary neutron star coalescences that's about 3 times better than the previous best instruments did. Okay? Now, the The plan is to do an observing run at this sensitivity for a few months, and then we actually go off the air again, do improvements, because we know what the path is to getting to the final design sensitivity, which is another factor of three better than the green design curve we have here, and so to make those improvements over the next 2 to 3 years. Okay, so that's the operational plan. Now, it turns out that at the same time as LIGO is, advanced LIGO is coming on the air, there's a global network of detectors. I already showed you a little bit of that before, but let me zoom in a little. So advanced LIGO, here we are, 2015, and those advanced LIGO detectors are coming on the air at the sensitivity that I showed. Now, it turns out that in next year, advanced Virgo will also come on the air with a comparable, with what we hope for will be a comparable sensitivity to advanced LIGO. So our second observing run, which is at the end of 2016, will be done in conjunction with advanced Virgo. At the same time, Kagra is being built right now and hopes to come on the air in the 2017 or 2018 timeframe. And finally, LIGO India is slated to come on the air in 2022. So why is this so important? Why do we need all of these detectors? They're not cheap, they're not easy. Now, it turns out that the angular response of these interferometric detectors is purely quadrupolar. So it looks like this. Here are the L-shaped arms of an interferometer, and this peanut-looking shape tells you what is the acceptance angle of this detector for sources on the sky. So when you look at through a telescope, you're looking at a very tiny field of view exactly in the direction that you point your telescope. These detectors don't have that ability. They actually accept signals from a fairly wide range of directions, except right along the plane of their arms. So each detector on its own can only localize a source to within a circle on the sky if you observe it for long enough. If you want to know where the sources are in the sky, you actually have to triangulate multiple detectors. And that localization depends very strongly on the signal-to-noise ratio of the source, and also on the number of detectors you have. So here then is a diagram of what you could do for localizing a source in the sky if you only had the two LIGO detectors and the Virgo detector. And what you can see as you plotted on the galactic plane is these large circles are the uncertainty circles of where a source would be. So you can see there are some regions in the sky where you have reasonably constrain the localization of the object, and other parts where you simply, the errors are too big. Now, if you're in the business of just detecting gravitational waves and saying, I found one, then this is fine. You know, it comes from anywhere and you can see it. But if you want to do any deeper scientific study of the sources, you really need to know where it's coming from. If you want to do any kind of follow-up with electromagnetic telescopes, and you go to your astronomer friends and say, I can tell you about this source within 100 square degrees, you get laughed out of the room. So it's pretty important that we try to constrain these a little bit better. And so here is then what we could do if we added to the network of the two US detectors and Virgo, the India detector. And you can see right here, there it is without India, and here we are with India. So it's quite a bit better. And so the motivation for adding a single other detector to the network is actually very high. Okay, so as we look into the future, sort of beyond advanced LIGO, so I hope I've given you some sense that we've built these instruments. We think we have a path forward to reaching design sensitivity. We're going to do these early observations of a few months at a time before we reach full design sensitivity. And the probabilities of detecting a source are increasingly getting better as we get to better sensitivity with the sort of the best estimates we have now. So it's also time to think, since this is convergence and we're thinking about, you know, how do fields come together and how do they have longevity, we're also thinking about what happens beyond this very next few years, observing runs with advanced LIGO. So here are some of the plans, dreams, you know, so in this direction, going from top to bottom, we go from plans to dreams to wild speculation. Okay, and same thing is this plot here does the same thing. Here is frequency on this axis versus strain on the vertical axis, same as the other benchmark plots that I showed. Here is the first LIGO Virgo detectors up here, and then as you make your progression down in this region here is where we are with the design sensitivity of advanced Virgo, and then plans for possible improvements of the dash green and the solid green curve. So the next 5 to 7 years, with a factor of 2 improvement, those technologies we think we have in hand, and I will close my talk with one of those. And so those are seen to be sort of advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo with upgrades. In that time frame, Kagra will come online, and not long after will be LIGO India. So our network of detectors at the sensitivities that I've just described, sort of at the which gives us, by the way, let me say what those sensitivities mean. When we get to these sort of advanced LIGO Virgo sensitivities, what we're able to do is we're able to say if we take a standard neutron star binary system, we can observe it out to a distance of about 200 megaparsecs, which is compared to initial LIGO, where we were able to look just about out to the Virgo cluster, which was 15 megaparsecs. And the reason why this is so important is these detectors are amplitude detectors. They measure the amplitude of the gravitational wave. So when you make a detector that's a factor of 10 more sensitive, you're actually able to probe a factor of 10 cubed greater volume in the universe. So the probabilities of detection and science go up very fast as the cube of the sensitivity. So when I say a factor of 2 improvement, and you know, we work very, very hard for each factor of 2, it's actually quite significant in terms of the astrophysical reach. So the near-term gains, I think they're in hand. Mid-term gains where we go for, you know, a factor of 4 improvement compared to the advanced LIGO design are getting very, very hard. If you're someone who's working on these instruments, it's getting to be a very difficult business, which then prompts you to ask if are you making a good choice to try to put better detectors in aging facilities of finite length and vacuum capabilities. And so there has been some thinking already begun both in Europe and in the US on new facilities which would have longer arms, for example, 10 to 40 kilometer detectors, where you could actually quite handily get another factor of 10 improvement. And when you get to these facilities, which are sort of longer arm facilities, then your ability to observe goes out to cosmological distances, so typically of redshifts of 5 to 7. So that's sort of what's coming down the pike in this field in over the next decades. Now, in the spirit of convergence, right? So, fields coming together. But I have to also admit this may be just a shameless plug for research in my own group. I want to talk about one example of an improvement that we're making to advance LIGO, where we use the techniques of quantum engineering to improve a gravitational wave detector. So if you recall, I had told you that advanced LIGO is limited by the quantum fluctuations of the light. And so what we have done recently in our group is we have engineered. So this is just a LIGO interferometer. It's a busy slide, but you don't have to worry about anything except here's the laser, here are all the mirrors of the interferometer. And then if you follow this light beam out, this little device here is where we detect the photons that carry the gravitational wave signal. And what we've done is we've actually created a source of entangled photon states and injected those into the interferometer. And using those quantum engineered states of light, we were able to show that we could make an improvement. So here again is, this is the red curve here is initial LIGO as it was operational in 2010. And then the blue curve is the improvement that we were able to realize by injecting our subquantum light state, our entangled light state into that. And at the time, we were able to realize a 25% improvement. But this was actually a very critical measurement to do, because this has now set forth the path for us where we're pretty confident that in the next upgrade in the 2017 or 18 timeframe for advanced LIGO, we would be able to get a sensitivity improvement of about a factor of 2. And again, remember, factors of 2 for us are just very important. So this is an example of where we were able to take some techniques from the quantum optics world and apply them to gravitational wave detectors. So let me wrap up by just telling you this is my view of where gravitational wave science is going to go in the next decade. All right, So this is the spectrum that I'd shown before, again, starting at the very low frequencies and ending up at the in the kilohertz range. And here we are at the very low frequencies where we're looking at the imprint of the primordial gravitational wave background on the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. Now, we all know about the announcement of the BICEP2 results, and in recent times where Planck has shown that that was probably unlikely. But I actually will go a bit farther and say that a lot with Planck and the South Pole Telescope and ACT and SPIDER and a number of these polarization experiments, it is very likely that in the next 5 to 10 years, we will observe the polarization signature of a gravitational wave background. So from the very early universe. Now, if you come down to the pulsar timing arrays, there are a number of international groups, the US one being NanoGrav, but the European pulsar timing array, or the Parkes pulsar timing array in Australia. And their limitation is twofold. One is they need better timing precision, because what they need is they need sources that are really good clocks so that they can see deviations from those timing. And so they need more sources, because we also know that even though many pulsars are very good clocks, many are also glitchy and a little unreliable. So as they build up the resources to detect, to measure more sources and to collect long-term timing data, I do believe that this method will also give results in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, at these millihertz frequency ranges where you need space detectors, I didn't really know what to predict. And that's because these are long-term, expensive projects. And so I do believe they will get resurrected if these other techniques start to succeed. But I'm not going to be able to speculate on in what form. And then finally, the terrestrial network, which is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years, LIGO, Virgo, and CAGRA. I'm here where we have a path to improve sensitivity. We are constantly working to get better theory and data analysis techniques. And then, of course, as we get more and more nodes in the network, sky localization and follow-up with electromagnetic telescopes will be a very important player. And so I'd like to end just by telling you that, you know, whether you're thinking about the very early universe or about, you know, warp spacetimes due to black holes or neutron stars, I think the next decade is, in fact, let me come back and say, the next 5 years is going to be a very interesting time. So thank you.